Okay, tonight's topic is the natural progression from last week's discussion of why we play dreidel on Hanukkah, establishing Jewishness on the basis of mitochondrial DNA evidence. What does this have to do with Parshas Vayigash? So last year, Parshas Vayigash, we discussed maternity and halacha, how halacha conceives of and defines maternity, based on the discussion of Shaul ben Akananis, who according to one tradition of Chazal was Shaul ben Dina, and if so, how could Dina have married Shimon if they're both siblings from the same mother and the same father? Maybe they didn't have the same mother. That was our discussion last year. This is the next level. There has been literature that just came out in the last year on the following topic. The major proponent of what we're going to discuss, the person who's done all the research, is a Dr. Carl Skorecki, affiliated with the Rambam Hospital in Israel. And he had a Skype conversation a couple months ago with Rav Shecht and Rabbi Willig about this, and this topic has been addressed in print in the last year in a tshuva printed at B'merei HaBazak, which is a collection of tshuvas by Kol Eretz Chem and Eretz Yisrael, in a tshuva by Rav Asher Weiss that was distributed at a Kenes Dayanim of the Batei Din Rabbaniyim in Eretz Yisrael this past summer, and in a standalone about a few months ago, co-authored by a Rabbi Birnbaum from the Beis Din in Russia, and Rabbi Zev Litka, who's an up-and-coming star in the world of Dayanus in Eretz Yisrael, with guest appearances by Rabbi David Lau and Dr. Steinberg, who have essays in the Sefer on this topic. What is the issue? That this Dr. Skorecki discovered that there's a certain strain or haplotype of mitochondrial DNA, where mitochondrial DNA is DNA that is only passed down through a mother, and there are certain haplotypes that exist which have a much stronger instance among Jews than among non-Jews. So in one example discussed in the literature, a certain haplotype appeared in 54 out of 1,500 Jews that were studied and only appeared in 7 out of 51,000 non-Jews. Or Rabbi Lau cites it as 64 out of 1,500 Jews and 3 out of 22,000 non-Jews. So these are significant differences between the appearance of this haplotype among the Jewish population, the appearance of the haplotype among the non-Jewish population. Does this have any significance in halacha that could in any way sway our determination as to whether a person who has this particular haplotype is Jewish in situations where we may not have sufficient evidence otherwise? The way the Shaila was presented in the B'marei HaBazak Shuva, B'marei HaBazak Chelek Tes from Kol Eretz Chemda, was someone from Germany posed the following question. There was a woman in the community who identified as Jewish, thought that she was Jewish, married to a non-Jew. The non-Jewish spouse has no interest in conversion, so she can't convert. But she thought that she's Jewish, but her grandmother hid everything after the war, and she has no evidence to prove her Jewishness. So for some reason, this person wanted to be Jewish, wanted to think that she's Jewish, even though she's married to a non-Jew. Probably better off if she's not Jewish. But the Shaila was asked, she underwent this mitochondrial DNA test, and it came out positive, so does that do anything for her to maybe push her towards being Jewish? The Shaila that Rav Asher was asked from Rav Ullman of the Sydney Beis Din was a little bit of a different case, but same general idea. There was a young Jewish fellow who left the Derech and married a non-Jewish woman in Sweden, and the parents, the grandparents of this young Jewish fellow were upset besides themselves that he intermarried. And lo and behold, the Messiah Lefituma, this young non-Jewish wife of the young Jewish guy, mentions to someone, oh, they told her once that her grandmother or great-grandmother may have been Jewish, and they had such a traditional family. Now, this young lady had no idea what that meant for her, that if the grandmother was Jewish, then she would also be Jewish. That wasn't really on her radar screen. She couldn't care less. Neither her husband nor her could care less if she's Jewish, but it would make the grandparents in Sydney happy if they could think in their mind that the grandson is really married to a nice Jewish girl, even if she doesn't realize it. So again, absent any hard evidence that the woman is Jewish, but given some circumstantial evidence, does this mitochondrial DNA test do anything to push things over the top or give us any more comfort level of the Jewishness of the person in question? So this is a different question, although there's some overlap, to the general question of reliance on DNA evidence in many areas of halacha, particularly in the case of Heter Agunos, as came up with the World Trade Center situations, where there is the ability to identify DNA through DNA evidence, through dental records, that someone had perished, even though the body never turned up. So that was the whole literature at the time, which many of the contemporary Gedolim weighed in on. How do we view DNA evidence in halacha? And again, that's not our issue here. There, we're talking about where the chances of any two people having this matching DNA is somewhere in the 1 in 10 billion range.
But one clarify that there's two types of DNA. There's nuclear DNA, DNA within the nucleus. Everybody has that. That's some from your mother, some from your father. Mitochondrial DNA is a separate DNA altogether. You can only get it from your mother.
Correct, right.
But that's where the open...
Right. So the first question of relying on DNA evidence, let's say, to establish that someone has been killed to allow his wife to remarry. So the Kollel at the time, that year, the Kollel Elyon Yeshiva was learning Yevamos, conveniently. So in that volume, the letter of the Yeshivas are printed from Rav Avadya, and it was Am Nechemya, who corresponded with Rabbi Willig. The letter of the literature is printed there from Rabbi Sandorovic of Milwaukee, which is also printed in his Asei B'Samim Simei Yudzayin. So the upshot of all the literature there is many contemporary poskim, Rav Osner and B'nai Brak, more or less went with this approach also, though perhaps with a slightly more conservative leading. But the general orientation was that we can view DNA evidence in this context as a Simen Mufak. What is a Simen Mufak? So we know the sugya in Bav Mitzi and Daf Kazayin in the context of Hashabbos Aveda, where the Gemara has a shayla whether Simanon Derais or Simanon Derabanan. Initially, that's in the context of returning a get on the basis of Simanim. So the Gemara assumes that if Simanim Deraisa, if a sign that you can identify something on the basis of is Deraisa, then you can return a get on the basis of that Simen. If Simanim Derabanan, you can't return a get on the basis of that Simen. And then what seems to emerge from the Maskanos of Gemara is that there are different levels of Simanim. There's a Simen Mufak, a Super Simen, a Simen Beinoni, and a Simen Garua. So the whole shayla of whether Simon Deraisa Derabanan, that's relevant to a Simon Beinoni. But everyone should agree that when it comes to a Simon Mufak, whether or not you hold Simon Deraisa Derabanan, you can be Machzer in Aveda, you can be Machzer Get, on the basis of a Simon Mufak. How is that relevant to the Heter of Eishes Ish? So that's what Tosus writes in the first page of the Marmar Kamos for Yevamos, Kuftes Vavam and Beis, Gibra Maskel Vakamri Simonim, the first Vakamri Simonim. So Tosus there assumes that this is relevant for Bimatra and Eishes Ish as well, that on the basis of a Simen Mufak, you can Bimatir and Eishes Ish. And that's what we assume like in Shulchan Aruch, on the second page of the Marmar Kamos, Simen Yudzayin Yerdeya Se'if Kaftala, that's the very long Simen about Heter Aguna. So the Mechaber writes there, Matzo Horeg Omeis, so if you find a dead body, Padachta V'chomo Persepon of Kayamim, V'kiru Behem Shuploni Me'idin Alav, so if you can identify his facial features, his head there, his nose, parts of Panim, so then you can be Matzer his wife on the basis of that identification. But if you can't identify his body, even if he has clothing that has a Simen Mufak, that's insufficient. Because we don't rely on a Simen Mufak on clothing, because maybe he borrowed the clothing. Afilu hayula simanim begufo, even if there are other simanim in the guf, afilu shuma eim eidin lav, aval. Hayula hem begufo, simanim mufak in the yosim eidin lav. But if he has a Simen Mufak in his body, that we can rely on to be Matthew, his wife. What is Rama quoting the Chuvah Sarash? Kigon Shahila Yeser or Chaser, he has an extra digit, or Shine Be'achem Eivar, or some distinct feature in one of his limbs, Aval Katan, or Arich, etc. Lo avi simen. If he's unusually short, unusually tall, that's not a sufficient simen. But if he has a very distinct feature, as a missing limb, a missing digit, a major shinui on the limb, that would be considered a simen mavuk. And if you find a dead body with such a simen, you could be matir his wife to remarry on that basis. Now, how do we define what's considered a simen mavuk? So there's a lashon under Rabbeinu Yerucham that the later Rachonim, or the earlier Rachonim pick up. But Rabbeinu Yerucham writes that a simen mavuk is only b'davar barur she'eino nimsa kach b'guf acher. Something that's clear that doesn't exist in any other body. So the earlier Achronim, because it's Rabbeinu Yerucham, assume generally that it's little lavdafki. It doesn't mean that there's only one person in the world that possibly has this simen. It means it's something that's not so shechiach. The lashon of the Masas Binyamin, simen samach gimel. Shuvas Masas Binyamin, simen samach gimel. The way he writes it is nira she'en kavanas Rabbeinu Yerucham alchisor yeser aver shalem. If he's totally missing a limb, that's definitely a simen mavuk. Even if it's a little bit less of a simen mavuk, but his formulation is, it's strange enough. So it's something that you don't find so often. You find it in 1 out of every 1,000, 1 out of every 2,000 people, but it's not something that's very common. So this is quoted by the Beis Shmuel here in Sifkat and Ayin Gimel. But the way the Beis Shmuel quotes it is, Sifkat and Ayin Beis. Simanim Ufakim, Ayin Shu with Masas Binyamin. The cause of a klal who shelo yimatzei rak echad mi elef who davers are muflis. He leaves out the echad mi alpayim. He just says echad mi elef, 1 out of every 1,000, not 1 out of every 1,000 or 2,000. So this Rabbi Birnbaum, in his essays in this new sefer, the sefer is called Birur Yadud Luor Mechkarim Genetiim. So he argues that if you look at many achronim, they have the formulation 1 in 1,000. So he argues that that's somehow dafka, very difficult to understand why that should be so. It's clear from the Masas Binyamin side that it's a rough estimate, 1,000, 2,000, a relatively small likelihood that anyone else could have such a simen. In terms of likelihoods, if we're looking at matching DNA, so we're talking about likelihood in the tens of billions that someone else would have the same identifying features. So then why is it even a shaila? Why would you think that DNA might not be considered a simen mufak? So some of the discussion was, well, number one, you can't really see it. So how do we know that's considered a simen if it's something you can't see? You're relying on scientific data. So many assume that here the scientist, Rabbi Willig, writes in his article that the scientific data here is so overwhelming, it's not like the numbers are somewhere at the border and maybe new evidence will come out and we'll recalculate. It seems so overwhelming that this is really exclusive to an individual in question. And there's other evidence that you don't necessarily have to see a simen in order for it to become a simen mufek. And one of the other questions that was raised, that Rabbi Willow talks about, Rabbi Sandrovic talks about, is the Rama also writes over here in the same si'if, that if you have a combination of simanim beinonim, do not a simen mufak make. So maybe if you're looking at DNA sequencing, if you isolate the various pieces of the sequencing, maybe those are multiple simanim that only in the total picture become a simen mufak. So maybe that's multiple simanim beinonim that shouldn't add up to a simen mufak. So Rabbi Willig, Rabbi Sandrovic point out that shouldn't be the case. The Piskei Tshuva indicates here that if you have multiple simanim beinonim on the same limb, that's considered a simen mufak, and this would be analogous to that as well. Rabbi Sandrovic assumes in Svara it doesn't make sense to say otherwise. So among those who weighed in on this question of DNA evidence for Eishes Ish, Zalman Nechemia was assumed as much that it's reliable, Rav Avadya assumed it's reliable, the Nishvas Avram quotes a personal conversation he had with Rav Yashiv, who said that it's reliable. So there seemed to be a strong consensus that that this is reliable in that context. Rav Vosner was quoted as saying, it's karav l'simen mufak, but under circumstances that was good enough as well. So that's the discussion about, much more to talk about, but not our focus now. That's the discussion, the old Shaila, the old in relative terms, of relying on DNA to identify or to establish that someone has lied to allow a wife to remarry. We won't talk about now the ramifications for Yerusha, for Mamzeris, or other issues where DNA evidence may be helpful or harmful. But the question is, how do we, if we're going to talk in terms of Sim and Wolfok, how do we address that in our context here? And there are really three issues to discuss. Number one is Sim and Wolfok. Number two, the Sarav Asher outlines it in his tshuva. Do we talk about an umdana, a situation where there's a likelihood of a certain narrative based on the evidence that we have? Or do we talk in terms of Rov, that there is a majority that would indicate someone's being Jewish on this basis? So as far as Sim and Muvuk, what they discuss is that this is a little bit different than the Sim and Muvuk we're talking about till now. Because on the one hand, how do we evaluate, so let's say we're going to look at the numbers. Let's take the 1 out of 1,000 model. So in order for something to be a Sim and Muvuk, the likelihood that someone else has a Simon has to be more than 1 in 1,000, 1 in 2,000. So the numbers we started with were, let's round it out a little bit. So you have this this sequencing of mitochondrial DNA that exists in, let's round the numbers, 50 out of 1,500 Jews and 7 out of 50,000 non-Jews. So that number, 7 out of 50,000, is definitely less than Echad Me'Aleph. But at the same time, as Rav Asher points out, and some of the others, and the Eretz Chemda Tshuva points out, if you look at the entire world population, there are more non-Jews that have this prototype than Jews, because there are 500 times more non-Jews than Jews in the world. So how do you look at these numbers?
Who says the non-Jews were Jews that converted or got blessed?
Okay, that would also be a possibility, but that would point you in the other direction. If you look at all the facts, so what's more likely? Do we look in terms of likelihood? Are we, how concerned are we about numbers? How does that fit into Sim and Muvuk? Are we evaluating based on numbers? Rav Asher points out the following as well. He's the most skeptical about relying on any of this. In terms of Sim and Muvuk, so the classic Sim and Muvuk is, let's talk about Hashabbos Aveda. Hashabbos Aveda, the way Rav Asher says it, is that there are two different parties that come together. There is the person who lost the Aveda. So he lost an Aveda with a certain Simon. And someone else finds an Aveda with the same Simon. So what's the likelihood that one person lost an Aveda that has the Simon and someone else independently found an Aveda with the very same Simon? Or let's talk in terms, he doesn't say like this, but let's talk in terms of person who dies. We know that someone is missing. We can't find him. Maybe he's dead, maybe he's alive. Then you find a dead body, and this dead body has the Sim and Muvuk. So we're talking about two different players here. There's someone who's lost, who's missing, that we need to identify, and then we find an unidentified dead body. So that may be different than what we're talking about here. Here there aren't two players. Here we're looking at a certain DNA sample. Does this DNA sample indicate that this person is from a certain percentage that have this the sample that are Jewish? So it may not be the same calculation in terms of identifying something as a Sim and Muvuk. Now let's talk about Umdana. What does Umdana mean? So some of the classic examples of Umdana are, let's say, the Gemara in Bava Kamma Tzadi Gimel, Gamal Ocher Ben Gamalim. So you find a camel hanging out among other camels, and then you find a dead one there. So do you have the right to assume that the camel that was hanging out there was the murderer of the dead animal? So that's the discussion there. Machlokas in the Gemara. Do we rely on that kind of an amasa to be mechayev the owner of the camel to make restitution to the owner of the animal that was killed? Right? So umdana there is, how do we evaluate the situation? We have, let's say, circumstantial evidence. So does that circumstantial evidence create an umdana, a likelihood that this is what happened? Or the case of Shimon ben Shatach, the Gemara in Sanhedrin Lamed Zayin, that he sees someone going into a room, and then out he comes with a bloody knife, and there is a dead body in the room. So can you assume that the person coming out with the bloody knife is the murderer of the person found dead in that room? He didn't see anything, but there is very significant circumstantial evidence. Or the Mishnah Gittin Samachay, Hayose Bekoler, someone's going out to be killed, and he says, Kisfu Gel Ishti, write a get for my wife, but it doesn't say Tenu. Write it, but it doesn't say give it. So do you have the right to assume, is there an umdana that, well, in the context, that's obviously what he meant. He meant that you should write a get and give it to my wife, because writing a get and holding on to it won't help anyone. So even though he didn't say it explicitly, there's an umdana, there's a likelihood that that was his intent. So would you say here also, do you have some kind of an umdana, a likelihood based on the circumstantial evidence and these studies, that there's a likelihood that given the instance of this prototype in Jews versus non-Jews, is there a likelihood in umdana that this person is Jewish? So in Rav Asher's Tshuva, he points out, again, not necessarily the same, because when the classic umdana is either meant to explain a Maisa Shahaya, something happened. So the camel, there's a dead camel. How did that camel get dead? Or someone's walking out with a bloody knife and there's a dead body in the room. Who killed? What? How do we explain the circumstance, the episode that happened in front of us? Or how do you explain someone's kavana? How do you explain the intent of this person who's being brought out to be killed and he says kisfu galishi? Do we assume that he meant kisfu tenu? Do we assume that he meant just kisfu? So that's different than here. We're talking about, can we establish some Jewishness on the basis of this this evidence? It's not really the same kind of an umdana. Rabbi Lau, in his essay, assumes that maybe umdana is more operative, but he discusses this in other terms of, well, when do we rely on umdana? Let's assume that this is a classic umdana. So the machlokes haposkim, do we rely on umdana to be motzi mamon? Those are some of the cases in the Gemara there. So do we rely on an umdana to be motzi mamon? Do we rely on an umdana for dinei nefashas? So dinei nefashas, it's more difficult to rely on an umdana to be motzi mamon. That's a machlokes rishon, machlokes haposkim. Do we rely on an umdana to be motzi mamon? But here we're talking about an umdana to establish someone as Jewish. So is that better, is that worse? So in theory, by iser v'heter, we should rely on an umdana. But maybe this isn't just Isser v'heter, maybe this is Darvish of Erva. Of course, another Yehuda, that some assume to establish someone as Jewish has nafkaminas for Arias. So that's the Darvish of Erva. So the threshold of evidence required for Darvish of Erva is higher. So maybe this should be a Darvish of Erva, and you can't rely on such an umdana. But he says there are others who are makilim about the umdana of Darvish of Erva. So he leaves this as an open question. His inclination is that, as a sniff, where there are other factors, it's something to consider, maybe throwing into the mix, but not to rely on, as I don't think anyone's prepared to rely on, alone. And the other issue that is raised, Rabbi Litka has an arichas about this. Rav Asher talks about it more b'kitzer because he wrote about the topic elsewhere. How does Roe fit in over here? So can you say, well, the majority of people that have this sequencing are Jewish? So does Roe fit into Biwur Yahadut in this kind of a context? So when I first heard about this issue of relying on mitochondrial DNA, my initial reaction was, oh, this should be Lishitasa about milk. That Rav Asher assumes that you're allowed to drink milk nowadays, even though statistically speaking, it is almost impossible that you're not going to be drinking milk from treifos, because the percentage of treifos in the cow population is significant, definitely more than shishim, probably up there in the 10, 20, 30% range. So lemaisa, if you're milking a lot of cows and all the milk gets mixed together, you don't have shishim or kosher cows against the treif cows, so how are you allowed to drink commercially processed milk? Yeah? So Rav Asher assumes, he writes this in Minchas Asher in Mishpatim, that Rove has nothing to do with statistics. There are halakhic principles of Rove. So Rove tells you that you look at each cow on its own. Each cow, you have the right to assume, comes to the Rove of cows that are not treifos. And therefore, even if they all get mixed together, then that's still kosher, because the halakhic principle of Rove trumps statistics. Rove is not a function of math. Rove is an independent halakhic principle. in the context of milk, there's a the remark within Nisr Hetter that very much sounds like that, but that's a conversation for another time. Rav Schechter, who doesn't drink milk, assumes that no, Rov is only a reflection of statistics. Under normal circumstances, absent other information, I have the right to assume that this cow is from the Rov. But if I have a statistical reality that tells me otherwise, so we follow statistics. Statistics doesn't exist. Rov doesn't exist independent of reality. Rov is supported by statistics. But if the statistics tell me otherwise, then I follow the science. Smachlogos is lishitasim in many other areas also. So Rav Asher assumes that no, Rov is a halachic principle, even if it's divorced from reality. That's why you're allowed to drink milk nowadays. That's why in the case of Tisha Chaniyos, you have your 9 kosher butcher shops. 1 non-kosher butcher shop, you have a piece of meat out on the streets. They have the right to assume that that piece of meat comes from the Rov stores that are kosher. Let's say you have 10 pieces of meat in front of the 10 stores. So you still have the right to eat all 10 pieces of meat, even though statistically speaking, one of those pieces of meat should be coming from the trade butcher store. So again, he thinks that's a raya to the fact that Rov is an independent halachic concept that exists without consideration of statistics. And Rov is only relevant to establish whether someone is considered to be part of the Rov or part of the Miyad, or someone is shy to that category of the Rov. So, Ksubas Daf Tesvav, the Mishnah. You find a baby out on the street, you don't know if he's born from a Jewish mother, born from a non-Jewish mother. So if Rov of the Bnei Ha'ir are Jewish, Machlokes Tanaim, Rov of the Bnei Ha'ir are Jewish, then you have the right to assume that the kid's Jewish. What about... If we're simply looking at statistics, so what's critical shouldn't be our Rov of the resident of the city Jewish. The question is our Rov of women of childbearing age who aren't already pregnant, or who aren't currently pregnant, Jewish. So that's about Machlokes Chachamim of Yehuda, but we paskin that you look at Rov of the city, you don't look at Rov of the people that potentially could be the mother of this child. So again, Rov is a halachic construct that doesn't necessarily exist in tandem with statistics. So with that approach, you would be more reluctant to assume just because we can create a mathematical equation here where the majority of people that have this halotype are Jewish, it doesn't necessarily mean that in the realm of Birur Yadut, that creates a halachic Rov. Rov exists only in certain contexts of halacha, and exists in a way that's not necessarily connected to statistics. If you drink milk, if you don't drink milk, so then maybe you'd be more likely to take this into consideration as a Rov, although there are many other factors why it might not be a Rov for that reason as well. Bottom line, this is something that's just being discussed now in the literature. I don't think anyone is suggesting that you'd establish some of the Jewishness on this basis, but it's something that may be worth exploring as a sniff. Were there other factors, other reasons to believe someone's Jewish, but you can't prove definitively? Rabbi Willig was inclined towards considering that on some level as circumstances would arise. I think Rav Schechter as well on some level, although it requires a little bit more research. Rabbi Lau was, Rabbi Litka is, Rav Asher is more skeptical, and the Eretz Chemda people conclude with a request that the Rabbanu should look into this more and discuss what the possible ramifications may be going forward. So there will be much more to talk about. This is just a preliminary presentation of what the potential issues are, and we'll have to see how things get fleshed out as we move on. Right, so we discussed that last year in terms of maternity, right? If you have the most of the genetic material coming from one mother, but you have mitochondrial DNA from another mother. So Rav Asher wrote about that also in a different journal.
Right. Now the CRISPR, right?
No, it's only mitochondria is only from the mother. Right, so this is a sequence that only exists on the...
So when they did the sample study, did they, right. they determine if both maternal and paternal, meaning from males and females, or it's not even a shine, because it would only mean...
This only goes on the maternal...
The maternal side.
Side, right.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah. Not sure what to think of that.
No, it shows you that those embryos are real people, not necessarily just...
Not necessarily. Not halacha, meaning.
We do know halachah Shabbos.
Halacha. However you view the halachic status of a